Well, God bless you this morning. It's good to be back with you again. We did have a good trip, and we enjoyed it very much. But it's good to be home again. It's very good to be home, even with all the miles and everything that went through. It's just no place like home. And if you happen to be discontent with your house and think it's too small, try living in an RV for a few weeks, then come home and your house turns into a real big house. And there's a blessing in that too. This morning, I'd like to invite your attention to Matthew chapter 5, verse 9 for our text verse here. Matthew 5, verse 9. And that simply says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God." Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. So when you think of a child, you think, you heard the term a chip off the old block, right? That simply means that the children is like its parent. The child is like its parent. Now, there's some children that don't take after their parents' characteristics. Maybe for whatever reason, they've decided that they want to react to how that is, and they want to be as different as possible. Well, even that, they still have some characteristics of the parent. So a peacemaker is called the child of God. That simply means, I believe, that God is a peacemaker. He loves peace. He loves order. When you have a piece of machinery, a well-oiled piece of machinery is good. It's something that works. The friction is reduced. You put oil or grease or lubrication in the parts and it works. It just moves nice. But if you put sand in that, it creates... The sand actually causes problems, right? So we could say that a peacemaker in a body of believers where there's many members, a peacemaker is someone who is like oil. They remove the sand or do the best to not be the sand. Blessed are the peacemakers. You know, God's kingdom is one of peace. His children are peacemakers. Jesus uses the illustration of a wolf that seeks to kill and destroy and scatter. Have you ever heard of a wolf being a peacemaker among sheep? You don't typically turn a wolf loose in among the sheep if you want them to get along with each other, right? Or to create harmony. Actually, the sheep will stick closer if the wolf is around, but a wolf seeks to kill and destroy and scatter. You know, peace is something that we all want. And it's a beautiful quality that we admire in other people. But did you know that it can be really costly sometimes? It can be. God is the author of peace. In 1 Corinthians 14, 33, it says, "For God is not the author of confusion, but of peace, as in all churches of the saints." Where peace is, there is order, and where chaos is, there is havoc. In the beginning, when God created the world, He made order out of chaos. God is a God of order. He likes things in their place. He wants his children to get along with each other, not be chaotic. He created a beautiful world, tranquil, peaceful. But then sin came and spoiled that. Now Satan, you know the story of Lucifer. I'm sure you do. You know, Lucifer was created as an angel. He was in the hierarchy of angels. He was one of the chief angels. He was called the son of the morning. He was a very good angel. He was created to be a good angel. But for whatever reason, Lucifer decided he wanted to have more. And so he wanted to be like God. He didn't think it was right that God was up here and he was, you know, partway up the ladder. He wanted to go all the way up. "I will be like God," he said. Well, the end result was that God cast him out of heaven. And he had gotten a following with him as well, evidently, because there was a third of those angels that were there that got cast out with him. Well, he's been very bitter all the way to now. And today we know him as Satan. He goes around. His goal is to disrupt everything God made. So God loves peace. God loves order. God loves tranquility. God loves when people get along. Well, here comes Satan, and he's like, He wants to break it up. He wants to pour sand in the gears. He wants to make chaos. And he's done a pretty good job of that. Or a bad job, however you want to say it. He's done a lot of chaos. Caused a lot of destruction and a lot of whatever. Just think, whatever God likes, Satan hates. So Satan's goal is to destroy peace. To create chaos and tear down God's order. Now think back. What was the first thing that's recorded that Satan did? You know? You remember a snake in a tree? Well, maybe not a tree, but a snake somewhere. And Eve was taking a walk and saw a snake, and the snake started talking to her. You think the snake was telling her to be a peacemaker? Not really. The first thing that it said, or the first thing, it started to question God's instructions. That's what he did, was question God's instructions. Satan planted doubt in Eve's mind by getting her to question God's intentions. Which Eve became deceived, and she thought she was going to better her life by doing this, even though it was different than what God had said. She thought she was going to be to better her life. But Adam just sinned. Adam was not deceived. He just did it anyway. Anyway, but that Satan's questions and doubts that he put in Eve's mind led her to let Eve and Adam to disobey God, and the deadly effects of sin were introduced into the world, into God's perfect world, God's perfect orderly world, and peaceful world. And we've been dealing with the death and destruction and chaos ever since. It's still around us. It's actually probably worse now than it ever was before. There's chaos everywhere, destruction, lawlessness. People, we don't want authority. We don't want order. We want to kick it off. We want to do our own thing. And it just gets worse and worse. But peace is a characteristic of Christ. Some Old Testament verses, the prophecies concerning Christ. In Isaiah 9, verse 6, he was prophesied as the Prince of Peace. "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder," or authority shall be given to him. "His name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace." He was prophesied as the Prince of Peace. Christ was an example of peacemaking. In 1 Peter 2:23, it's talking about Christ, who, when he was reviled, reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. When he was reviled not again. When he suffered, he threatened not, but committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. This is just a side note here, but do you understand the self-control that Christ had there? How would you have handled it if you had, all you had to do was just say the word, and you could have the whole army of heaven right there. You could have had all the nuclear bombs right there to wipe all your problem away. The person that's whipping you, the person that's handcuffing you, the person that's yelling in your face or hitting you with the whip or whatever, reviling you. And all you had to do was just ask, and they would be right there. These people, it'd be gone. You could be out of it. Done. Out of it. No. He committed himself to him that judgeth righteously. And in our Sunday school lesson, we talked about a high priest that knows our infirmities. Well, how does he know our infirmities? It's because he committed himself to him that judged righteously, right? He knows what it feels like to be reviled. He knows what it feels like to be threatened and to suffer. And it's because he didn't remove himself from that situation. And he went through that. He knows what it's like to be in conflict. You know, peace is the absence of turmoil. Peace plus structure equals order. And God loves that. He loves order. Peace without structure can degenerate back into chaos. Now, the reason I say that, peace without structure degenerates back into chaos, there's an annual meeting, or maybe, I don't know how often it is, but I think it's an annual meeting of people who are what we call counterculture people or hippies or whatever. Their motto is peace. They all get together, but they have a problem. Everybody is so peace loving and peaceful and get along with everyone else, then nobody should do anything they don't want to do, and nobody should do any work and all that. But all these people are here and nobody prepares anything, and how do you feed all these people? Well, somebody's going to have to work, right? So there's some enterprising people that maybe get together and have a few limited funds, and they set up a kitchen and they start working, and everybody else, they just come and eat all the food. Well, then there's what? It causes some chaos because there's some feelings that happen. Anyway, all of a sudden, the peace without structure degenerates into chaos. And it works in other ways, too. We see it sometimes in churches where we don't want any structure. We just want everybody to come together and worship and have brotherhood. But feelings can develop and chaos can come out of it. And is that of God? Is that of God? You can answer that question yourself. But order is a result of peace. Where there's peace and order, life can grow. A nation at peace is an environment for economic growth, for academic growth, for learning and culture development. A church at peace is an environment for spiritual growth. And a church that has chaos is not an environment for church, for spiritual growth. Peace between brethren is a beautiful example of Christ at work. And there's a question there. Can God's kingdom be built without peace? If God is the author of peace and Satan is the author of confusion and chaos, can God's kingdom be built without peace? Now, sometimes we're put in situations where we have opportunity to contribute to building peace or to add to chaos. Have you ever been in a situation like that? Where you have the opportunity to contribute to peace or to add to the chaos? What do we do with these opportunities? What do we do? Proverbs 15 verse 1 says, a soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. A soft answer turneth away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. There was, a few years ago, there was a man, he was a little bit of a scrappy individual, and he liked to take the grievous words route. That was his way of dealing with his neighbor. And he had a suspicion that his neighbors were stealing scraps of copper pipe from under his porch, and he lived in a little shack up on a hill, and he had a little porch that was out, and he had some trash copper pipes. I don't know, they weren't worth anything, but until somebody stole them, then all of a sudden he didn't like that. But he had some couple pieces of short copper pipes under his porch, he said, and when he went underneath and was looking under his porch, he saw they were missing. And so his first thought was the neighbor down the hill, which was about 50 feet away, was the culprit. So his grievous words were, he stuck a sign, a big sign, a piece of plywood, I think it was, and he spray painted on the side of his sign, God hates a thief. And he planted it 45 feet away from his house, right on the property line, and pointed at them. Now, they're on the back end of a gravel road, so there's no way that it was for the traffic going by. It was only for the neighbors. And he came down. Now, ironically, these people were both customers, and he came down and was complaining about his terrible neighbors that he had. And he put the sign up there for him, and he would sit on his porch and yell at them too, just so they wouldn't think he liked them. So he just yelled at them. And it's because they stole a couple pieces of this copper pipe from under his porch. Well, later that afternoon or the next day, the neighbors came in and they were talking about their cranky neighbor that sits on the porch and yells at him and puts a sign out that says God hates a thief, and they have no idea why he put a sign out there. Anyway, but it turned into a feud. Do you think that a little bit of communication might have been peaceful thing? Well, a soft answer turns away wrath, but grievous words stir up anger. And it still works that way, even after Solomon figured it out. Children have opportunities to be peacemakers. Sometimes there are situations where there are two pieces of candy and there's three people. Do you ever run into that? Or there's times when insults are thrown around and opportunity is given to respond. So a response to an insult can escalate or de-escalate a situation. Think about this. If there's one toy and there's five children, it's all peaceful as long as the toy is shared around. But as soon as somebody starts taking more than their share, then there's an opportunity for chaos. But we all have an opportunity to be peacemakers. I just use children because they're more forgiving than some adults are, so I could probably use some other illustrations, but there's other scenarios that happen to all of us. And maybe someone bluntly or angrily shares our faults or shortcomings with us, just directly, right up, no love. We'll say it that way. There's no love. They just come up and they start telling us how it is. Because it's true. They say it's true. And we don't think it's true. And we have a list of our own to share with them. Maybe. Or rumor comes back to us of something that was shared about us that we don't feel is accurate. And it kind of puts us in a uncomfortable light, or our reputation isn't been giving the credit it deserves. What do we do? Or our neighbors are impossibly annoying. We have really good neighbors, so I don't know what that's like exactly, but I'm sure there's some that don't have that. Or difficult customers. Do we use that as an opportunity to be peacemaker? Be a peacemaker. Do we reflect Jesus? Or what about a business deal? This is unfortunate, but it happens. With a brother in the church that we feel we got shorted on. How do we respond? These are things that have happened to other people, and I'm sure a form has maybe happened to you. I don't know. But how do you respond? How do you respond to that? The tongue of the wise in Proverbs 15, verse 2, this is after the soft answer turns away wrath. The tongue of the wise useth knowledge aright. The tongue of the wise useth knowledge aright, but the mouth of fools poureth out foolishness. What do you do when you know something about somebody that just has to be said? Have you ever known something about someone that just has to be said? I mean, it's too good. We can't keep the story. We got to share it. But it might, if somebody shared the same thing about you, would it be quite as good a story? The tongue of the wise useth knowledge aright. If you use it wrong, then what are you? The mouth of fools poureth out foolishness. But also, you're not a peacemaker. And if you're not a peacemaker, then how do people know if you're the child of God or not? Anyway, that's an argument you can go in a circle with. And it doesn't really have a very nice ending sometimes. But we hear some news, sensational news about a mutual acquaintance that's at best unflattering or worst highly damaging to their reputation. What do we do with the opportunity? What do you do? And what does it take to be a peacemaker? What does it take to be a peacemaker? Now, there was a man in the Old Testament that was a peacemaker. His name was Abraham. Now, Abraham was a very wealthy man. And Abraham had some things happen in his life that were difficult. You know the story of Abraham. He lived in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. And he had everything going on for him. He was a man that had life going well. And God called him right out of that to move. And God said, I want you to move, Abraham, but you're not going to know where you're going to go. You just have to move. So Abraham listened to God, and he moved and started driving west. Or I guess it was west, because Ur was far in the east, and he just kind of migrated along the way. But he just kept going and kept going and kept going until God told him to stop. He actually took his dad with him. He took his dad and he took his nephew with him, his brother's son. Now, his brother had died, so his nephew, Abraham, took him under his wing. He was kind of helping him along as a next of kin. He was kind of like his dad, but he was his uncle. But Abraham's dad went with him. Now, Abraham's dad didn't have the connection with God exactly that Abraham did, but he wanted to be with Abraham, so they went along and they got to a place. Was it Haran, I believe it was? They lived there for a while, and Abraham's dad passed away there. But then they kept moving. Kept going and kept going, and they ended up in Egypt, and Abraham did some things he shouldn't have done, and anyway, he got pushed out of Egypt again. But Lot kept going with him. Lot was his nephew. And they went all over and they acquired a little bit here and a little bit there, and things went well for him. And Abraham became wealthy. And Lot, he got his start in life and he became wealthy. Abraham may have helped him out, I don't know. But they were both wealthy and they were trying to farm where there wasn't enough grass. In Genesis 13, kind of breaks into the story here. Verse 1, I'm going to read a few verses here. Genesis 13, verse 1, gives a little bit of that account of Abram here. It says, "And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife, and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the south." Remember, they went to Florida. "And Abram was very rich in cattle and silver and in gold. And he went on his journeys from the south even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Hai, unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. And Lot also, which went with Abram, had flocks and herds and tents. And the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. And there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled then in the land. And Abram said unto Lot, Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I'll go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like unto the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent toward Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. And the Lord said unto Abram, after that Lot was separated from him, Lift up now thine eyes, and look from the place where thou art, northward, and southward, and eastward, and westward. For all the land which thou seest to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it, and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Then Abram removed his tent, and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. So here's Lot had come up, and he had flocks and herds, and he had his own enterprise, and there was not enough water for everything. There was not enough grass. And their servants were just fighting back and forth, because if Abram's flocks went through an area, if all his animals went through, then the grass was all eaten up. And Lot's ate the grass over here, but they needed more grass, and so they'd go over into Abram's territory and try to eat some, and Abram's would come over into Lot's territory and they'd try to eat some grass, and there was friction there. It was overpopulated with animals and people, and I'm not sure what all. Both of them had thriving businesses, and there was stiff competition. In fact, you know, how are they going to grow this thing if there wasn't enough food? You know, Abram was the more established business, maybe. He was the more established one. But he was also the father figure in this. This tension was getting worse and worse. And Abram said, you know, Lot, we can't do this. We can't have this tension going on. It's going to be a problem. And Abram knew that Lot had a lot of animals and a lot of things, but he said, look, it's not going to work for us to just kind of all have the same headquarters here. We're going to have to separate this out. You're old enough now. It's time for you to start your own enterprise. We're going to separate this. But I'm going to give you the opportunity, Lot, to choose where you want to go. You can pick anything you want to around here. You pick the territory, and I'll go the other way. And so Lot did that. Now, Lot was not as mature as Abraham was. Lot was not as generous as Abraham was. So Lot picked the best for himself and left. And the competition, they were not in each other's faces anymore. Their servants weren't. Their workers were not fighting it out anymore. But I think Abram was a little bit unhappy with the way Lot took the best for himself. They were humans, just like you are, we are. But just reading between the lines, I think Abram was just a little bit disappointed in Lot. Maybe a whole lot. I don't know. He was disappointed enough anyway that he was struggling with his feelings. And God came to Abram and said, Abram, look, you look all around you. You look 360 degrees around you. And I will give you all the land that you can see all around. I'll give it to you and your descendants. Because I will make a great nation of you, Abram. I will do that. But you know what Abram was called? He was called the friend of God. Abram was called the friend of God because he made peace with Lot. He was called the friend of God. Well, one of the reasons that was because he made peace with Lot. But Abram made a decision that at first cut into his profits. They cut into his livelihood, his net worth, you could say. And for his good actions, his good deeds, his generosity, he was rewarded with a lumpy, bumpy stick. Do we find ourselves in similar circumstances sometimes? Have you ever faced something like that? And how did you respond? Or how would you respond? You know, life is full of tests and opportunities to make peace. It's all around us. In Acts, a New Testament scenario, in Acts 15:36, there was two missionaries that were on fire to spread the gospel. We had a junior and a senior. Now, Barnabas would have been the senior one. He would have been the one that took Paul under his wing, or Saul at that time. And if Paul would have remembered, Paul had a lot of good ideas and good knowledge and good thoughts. But if he thought back when he first came to the group, it was Barnabas that took him under his wing. It was Barnabas that kind of covered him with his influence and helped bring him in. It was Barnabas that was his mentor, maybe. Someone who stuck his neck out the person that everybody feared, that he was maybe a little bit hard to get along with at times. Barnabas was the man that did that. Barnabas was known as a son of consolation. But they went on a missionary trip together, and Barnabas did his thing again, and he stuck his neck out for somebody else, John Mark, and they took him along, and John Mark did something terrible. he abandoned them halfway through and went back home to mom or wherever he went. I'm not sure where he went, but he left. And Barnabas thought John Mark was irresponsible. I mean, Paul thought that Barnabas was irresponsible and just not worth having, and we don't need him with us, whatever. Well, they finished their tour and they came back, and it was time to go out again. And that's where verse 36 comes in here in Acts 15. Some days after, Paul said unto Barnabas, "Let's go again and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they do." And Barnabas determined to take with them John, whose surname was Mark. Barnabas said, "Let's give him another chance. Let's go again." But Paul thought not good to take him with them. In fact, it was more than just he felt not good about it. He was very strong about it. No. He did not want to take him with them, who departed from them from Pamphylia and went not with them to the work. And the contention was so sharp between them that they departed asunder, one from the other. And so Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus, and Paul chose Silas and departed, being recommended by the brethren unto the grace of God. The brethren chose Silas, who was recommended unto the grace of God. Maybe they thought Silas needed extra grace to go with Paul. I don't know. But they had two people that were stubborn enough in their ideas that they couldn't get along with each other, so they went separate ways. And God used that. They were very committed people. Both of them were very committed people and very much on fire for God. But they had this contention. It was very much of a contention. They were still able to spread the gospel, but I think it was a flaw that's listed here for our learning, that we deal sometimes with our own stubbornness. We have two people that are stubborn, and when you have two stubborn-minded, when you have two people that are stubborn, there's no peace because nobody's willing to be a peacemaker. Being a peacemaker involves laying down some of our stubbornness sometimes. Paul didn't let his disagreement make him bitter, though. He didn't throw in the towel and say, "Well, Barnabas, if you're going to act like that, I'm not going to go on this trip anymore." They were able to come to a solution, even though they had to do it separately. They were able to come to a solution and go. And God used it. I do think, I don't have it right in front of me, but I think they patched things up later on in there. Sort of. And Paul doesn't speak ill of Barnabas in his writings. I don't know what Barnabas's writings were. I don't know. But I don't know that they spoke ill of each other, but they worked better independently of each other. And sometimes being a peacemaker involves separating. Sometimes it does. Being a peacemaker does not involve, if there is a separation that happens, with personality or even stubbornness, does not involve keeping on proclaiming bad things, tearing the other person down. It doesn't do that. Being a peacemaker is speaking the truth in love and then building each other up. Some verses to keep in our minds. In Romans 8, verse 6, it says, "For to be carnally minded is death." Carnally minded would be focused on myself, what I want, getting the best land for me maybe, or whatever. "But to be spiritually minded is life and peace." That's one way of doing it. Spiritually minded is life and peace. Carnally minded is being selfish and looking out for me. It glories in sowing discord, in tearing others down. It does not make for peace. Romans 14, verse 19 says, "Let us therefore follow after the things which make for peace, and things wherewith one may edify another or build someone else up. Encourage. Ephesians 4:3, endeavoring or keeping on seeking to keep the unity of the Spirit, God's Spirit, in the bond of peace. Hebrews 12:14, follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. It takes peace and holiness to see the Lord. Follow after that. Galatians 5:22, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, and faith. There's a lot of thoughts there. 2 Corinthians 13:11, finally, brethren, farewell. This is Paul's writings. Farewell. Be perfect. Be of good comfort. Be of one mind. Live in peace, and the God of love and peace shall be with you. You know, God is the author of peace. Making peace is a proof that Christ is working in our life. The devil's work is to create havoc and destroy peace. So remember that principle there. Wherever we can, let's create environments of peace. Environments where God's kingdom can be built, where the devil is not allowed to work his destruction. And back to Matthew 5, verse 9, it says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are the children of God, for they are peacemakers. That would be another way of saying it. But God bless you all this morning. I'm sure there's places in life, and probably will be places this coming week, where you'll have opportunity to be a peacemaker. Let's bow our heads for prayer.